This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, Matt Desch, the CEO of Iridium Communications, tells us about the satellites being placed into orbit and the services they'll provide to aviation. In the news, airlines react to the laptop ban, a proposed TSA fee increase draws criticism, FAA forecasts slow growth for general aviation, and an engine manufacturer looks to expand. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 445 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and I'm joined by a couple of co-hosts. First, we have Rob Mark. He's senior editor at Flying Magazine. He's also a flight instructor, and he publishes the Jetwine blog. Hi, Rob.
Hey, good evening to everybody all over the world, because it's a wonderful night because there's no snow here in Chicago.
Finally. Also with us is the other Max, Max from the West, Max Trescott. He's a CFI, an author, and he's a glass cockpit expert. And I bet you got no snow out there in California.
Certainly not here, that's for sure. Yep, and I got to say, I had a great day. I had a nice flight this morning and then came home and took a short nap. Does it get any better than that?
Gotta love those naps.
Just don't nap while you're on the short flight.
Alrighty.
Yeah, or in the next 90 minutes.
Well, that's what the autopilot's for.
All right. Well, our guest this episode is Matt Desch. He's actually a returning guest. He's the CEO of Iridium Communications. Now, under his leadership over the last 10 years, Iridium has grown from being primarily a satellite phone company to a global communications company. Iridium provides service on ships and airplane cockpits and for military applications. Matt is a longtime telecom and technology executive. He started his career at Bell Laboratories. He was an early pioneer in the cellular phone business. Matt's been involved with a number of high-tech companies over the years prior to becoming CEO at Iridium. Now, the Iridium network that was launched initially by Motorola back in the 1990s, it's getting a refresh now. And Matt has been leading that effort over the last, about 7 years or so?
That's right.
Well, welcome back to the Airplane Geeks Podcast, Matt.
Great to be with you guys. I'm not a rookie anymore.
That's right. You're joining the club of the repeat guests.
Yeah, stick around. You'll get your five-time jacket soon. Just like SNL.
Well, it's an honor.
It's a pleasure to have you back. We've got some exciting things to talk about. First, we've got some aviation news from the past week. So to get started with that, I'll ask, is everyone ready?
As ready as we're going to be.
Ready from the West.
Well, to start this off, we've seen that a number of airlines that have been affected by the ban on personal electronic devices have been quick to react. We have a couple of interesting articles that we'll have in the show notes, but we do see that Royal Jordanian has continued its, well, you might say snarky sometimes, and apparently effective marketing campaign that pokes fun at the U.S. presidential election and at recent government policies. They've even started to publishing or tweeting some, I guess you call this poetry. One of the recent ones here that we see is, and I'm not the greatest poetry reader, so, give me a little bit of slack, but Royal Jordanian says, "Every week a new ban, travel to the U.S. since you can. We are now poets because of you, son. No one can ruin our in-flight fun. We have good tips for everyone." So, and that's followed by 12 things to do on a 12-hour flight with no laptop or tablet. And it's a really kind of interesting, fun List ranges from read a book, enjoy a light snack, say hello to the person next to you, spend an hour deciding what to watch, appreciate the miracle of flight. I like that. Reclaim territory on armrest. There's a good one. Analyze the meaning of life. And the 12th one is think of reasons why you don't have a laptop. So it's kind of tough going for some of these airlines that are affected by this, what's generally called a laptop ban, I guess. But they're trying to make the best of it.
They don't have much choice, really, do they?
No, they don't.
I mean, you think about the folks that have just decided over the years that a long flight from here to there and back is good work time if you put on some headphones and you can play a little jazz in the background and do a little whatever it is you do on your laptop. And now you're going to do something different on the way back from the Middle East. Yeah,
you're going to have to. Emirates started up something I thought was very interesting. It's a service. And the idea is you can keep your tablets and laptops with you in the boarding area, working or doing whatever you'd like to do. Kind of up until the last minute, up until boarding. And then Emirates is providing a service where they package up your device, put it in, I don't know, some kind of a box or crate or something that goes into the cargo hold. So I guess they're actually helping you stay online longer and also helping protect your fragile devices when they're in the cargo bay. I thought that was kind of a clever idea.
Yeah.
Well, got to make lemonade when you've got lemons. I guess the big question that really comes out of this is why? And a lot of folks have said, does this really improve security if you take things that have lithium batteries in them and you move them from the cabin down to the luggage area? You know, do you really want that stuff down in checked baggage? That seems like it would trade off one potential kind of risk for a much worse one potentially. So I guess I've also read speculation that perhaps, it might not just have been about security, but it might be perhaps about punishing, some airlines that are competing with American Airlines. So oddly, there are no American Airlines that fly on these particular routes. No American carrier flies directly to any of these cities for which the ban is targeted. So it kind of makes one wonder what's it all about? What is the threat or what is the real reason behind this?
You know, I hadn't thought about that battery thing. That's something you get at check-in. Are you carrying any lithium ion batteries, or you don't have any lithium ion batteries in your check bags, do you? And you always go, no, because I've got them here in my laptop and whatever. That's an interesting part of this that I don't think anybody's talked about before. But I forgot what the other part of your question was, but I love the part about the batteries, Mac.
Well, there you go. That's why we have the electrical engineer on the show.
Yeah, well, I don't quite understand it at all. In the fact that if they're concerned about bombs, being made in a laptop, which I understand they've now believe that it's possible to do. I don't know why putting a bomb in baggage, the baggage hold is better than leaving the bomb up with you in the cabin. I assume things can be remotely detonated or put on timers. I don't want to give anybody any ideas here, of course. Sure. But
sure, and let's not forget when this all hit, a week or 10 days ago, they gave them, 5 days or 7 days or something to make it all come together. And I thought, well, how big a threat can it be if we're going to, give people time to work it all out? But, based on what you said, that there are none of these carriers that fly directly to the U.S. from the Middle East. These guys code share. They've got a code share with some of the U.S. carriers, don't they?
And I think some people have pointed that out, that, if you're intent on bringing something that is explosive or whatever, that you could relatively easily, instead of taking a, direct flight, you could hop around and, get here via a different route. The thing that I guess that I kind of conclude is that we're never really going to, I don't think we're really ever going to know what the threat is or was or the nature of it. I mean, we have a descriptions that you know, the evidence has been that certain terrorist groups have been working towards developing explosives that are very small and compact and difficult to detect. And it's sort of an extrapolation of that. But, I mean, no one's going to come, because we never do here. I just sort of see this as we have a shoe bomber, so we take our shoes off. And then we have a threat of explosives in liquids, and so we have a liquids ban. Now we have, I guess, the threat of explosive devices hidden in electronic devices, and so we don't have electronic devices. This ban is, you know, much more regional or much more pinpoint in terms of, you know, who has to comply with it. And so that does make you wonder what the motivation is. But I'm not sure we'll ever really know.
But can you imagine if this ban came into effect in Western Europe or in the United States? It would shut down the airline industry, or at least it would clean out the airplanes pretty well.
Yeah, so the UK has picked up the same ban, and I think other countries are considering it as well. So it's not just, you know, U.S. certainly led on this, but some other countries are now adopting the same ban.
What's interesting, though, is that the UK is banning them from different countries than the U.S. is banning, and you would think right. that they would be coordinated there about that.
Yeah, that makes you really wonder. Well, I think this is a saga that will continue for some time. Hopefully not, but again, the airlines that are affected by that are trying to promote their in-flight entertainment systems and, again, you know, Max T said, make lemonade out of lemons and try to do the best they can. All right, let's, push ahead. And we have an article from Skift, and this is U.S. Airlines push back against proposed TSA fee hikes. Now, according to this article, the Trump administration is proposing to increase the TSA fee that passengers pay, but the U.S. airline trade group Airlines for America says that each year about $1.3 billion of the fees that are collected do not go to fund aviation security. Instead, they are allocated to the overall deficit reduction. Boy, I wasn't sure that much of the fees was getting siphoned off for that purpose. But AOA is trying to communicate that rather than increase the fees, why don't we just keep the money in the TSA?
I guess I wonder how much they are thinking of increasing them and what that would do to that overall bottom line, how much they'd be raising per year. Is it more than that 1.3?
No.
Is it 1.3 billion, I think?
Yes, yeah. No, I think it's small. I think it's like around a dollar per ticket, which doesn't sound like a lot.
But I wonder what that does on that annual basis. Does it end up being a big cut out of 1.3 billion, or is it almost meaningless?
Well, the other thing that's going on in parallel, which is kind of interesting, I believe the budget proposal, which came out, they call it, the skinny budget, I guess that's the original version that comes out, it was calling for a cut in funding for TSA. So, I mean, they're kind of moving in the other direction, you know, is raising money and cutting the funding to the agency. I got to say, I have thought that TSA has a few activities that could afford to be cut. The Viper program, where they had, you know, people going out on the interstates, you know, stopping and looking for terrorists in, you know, the middle of the country. I mean, some of that stuff, to me, told me they perhaps had a little too much money in their budget.
Yeah, maybe that's why they've been siphoning some of this off, because giving them even more money is, you know, what are they going to do with it? Certainly, it's got a huge budget. I mean, the costs for, well, the Department of Homeland Security in general and the TSA in particular is pretty large. And, you know, it seems like there's been some kind of unwise investments, big investments, things like puffer machines, you know, for detecting explosives. There's been a number of high dollar value machines, technology implemented at airports that just it seems like it just really hasn't worked out as hoped, but they've been just gigantically expensive.
Yeah, but yeah, you know what else I'd be interested in is I wonder if any of that $1.3 billion actually went to deficit reduction.
Supposedly. I think that's what you're suggesting.
Well,
maybe
that's what it was supposed to be.
Oh, okay.
I'm just curious.
All so right. Your point is, how come the deficit isn't smaller?
Yes.
Of course, $1.3 billion is a lot of money, but compared to the deficit, not so much.
Yep.
All right. Let's look at an article from BizJournals. This is about the new FAA forecast, slow general aviation growth and drone explosion. That doesn't mean drones exploding, but the number of them perhaps growing dramatically. So what we see here is that in its 20-year forecast, the FAA has estimated slow growth for general aviation. They see a decline over the next 20 years in fixed-wing piston aircraft of 17,500 aircraft. That offsets a small increase in turbine aircraft growth in other segments. But overall, for general aviation, the net growth rate, 0.1%. That's about as flat as you can get.
Yeah, and all that growth is from the high end, from the turboprops and business jets, and you know, it just barely offsets the decline on the piston business. But the piston business has been headed steadily down for, oh gosh, probably close to 40 years. I think the peak year was, what, 1979, when they sold, perhaps 17,000, 18,000 units in a single year. And unfortunately, I think that was a spike that was caused by, you know, a variety of things. It was a lot easier to buy an airplane then. There was a lot of, you know, easy money. So that was probably a bit of a bubble. So from a comparison purpose, you know, that high water mark is probably not a fair comparison. But yeah, it's true. For years now, pistons have just been declining like crazy, which says, I guess, the money is going into the high end of the market.
Regarding the drones, the FAA says or predicts that in just the next 5 years, forget 20 years, but in the next 5 years, they expect the number of small model hobbyist drones to triple in size, bringing it up to 3.5 million units by 2021. Lots of small drones.
And we have to realize that we know there's going to be a deal somewhere. I mean, somebody is going to get whacked by a drone or have a drone whack them. I don't think we can possibly imagine that with that kind of number, there's not going to be some sort of an incident. And I just hope it's, you know, a glancing blow or something, as opposed to some airplane getting taken down.
Yeah, certainly. As far as commercial drones, FAA says that they expect the fleet of those to grow from 42,000 at the end of last year, at the end of 2016, to 442,000 by the end of 2021. They say it might even go higher than that. The FAA says that it's a dynamic market. Growth in the commercial side of for drones could be even more than that. They also look at the commercial aviation. FAA projects that U.S. passenger growth of 1.9% per year over the next two decades.
Well, and I have to laugh at that 3.5 million number of drones by 2021. You realize that's the total number of drones. If you subtract out the ones that are crashed, it'll only be 500,000 by 2021.
Yeah, it's sold, not flying. Yeah, that's a good point.
Yep, they don't last very long, at least not in my hands.
Yeah, easy to buy, easy to crash.
Exactly.
This FAA forecast also says something I thought was kind of interesting, and this was in the summary of the forecast. They say that because of the actions that the airlines took after the recession of 2007-2009, that the sort of the historic pattern of boom to bust business cycles has been replaced by what they call one of sustainable profits. What they point out is that the airlines have done a great job of managing operating costs, of replacing old equipment, eliminating unprofitable routes. We've seen consolidation, certainly, and also the rise or the growth of fee-based business models. So they think that the commercial aviation is in great shape, even to the point where the FAA says we're not going to see these swings, these boom to bust kinds of business cycles that we've seen in the past. It seems kind of reasonable, but I don't think the airlines are totally immune to it. I mean, anything can happen.
They'll just come up with another fee. There's the profit fee. The airline needs to make a profit, and we're not doing it, so we've added 4.7% to the price of your ticket.
Hmm.
Interesting thought. Anyway.
Well, And how quickly we forget, how many years ago when the government was just bailing out the airlines because they were, you know, barely sustaining themselves. I mean, historically, if you look over the years, I think the airline industry has been a very, very, very tough one. And certainly all the blame doesn't fall on them. But, you know, you often look to them and go, wow, is this really the most creative industry out there? It's hard for them to make money. Yes, they definitely have had their act together here for the last 8 or 10 years. And maybe that's partially because of all the consolidation. It's probably easier to make money when you've got fewer players, fewer people in the industry. But I would say the jury is still out. It would be fun to look back, you know, 10 or 20 years from now and say, was this just a blip, or have they really gotten onto a new pattern where they can somehow buck the business cycle and, you know, be continuously profitable all the time?
Yeah. Matt, how much does these kinds of forecasts affect your business? I mean, you're looking at your customer base and your future customer base and looking at the demand for service and so forth, I have to believe. Are your business plans highly sensitive to these kinds of forecasts?
Well, not at this time, because we're driven at this point, at least, by getting a data connection to a satellite in airplanes, and there's an awful lot of them that don't have that today. But, you know, to the extent that we're not growing, that certainly isn't good for the industry. It isn't good for us. It isn't good for anyone who's around industry. I think there's still a lot of opportunity, certainly, to bring all the airplanes we have online, but we all want the industry to grow, you know. So.
Sure.
It's important. I do think, by the way, that one of the things that's really helped the airlines the last couple of years has been fuel costs. You know, that's really dropped and been maybe an unexpected boon during all this consolidation that's gone on. And, you know, more and more efficient airplanes are important to drive revenue, too. I do think, you know, entertainment and additional revenue sources for them is going to be important in the future, too. And those do require data links as well.
Sure. Yeah, I think it's an interesting point about the fuel costs. I suspect that if fuel these days had stayed at the peaks, at their historic highs, that we would be looking at a very different situation right now. So kind of fortuitous, I think, that the fuel prices did go down as much as they did. All right, one final story. This comes from AOPA. Continental Motors to expand dramatically. Now, Continental Motors, they plan to break ground later this year on a new $70 million manufacturing center and corporate headquarters in Mobile, Alabama. I think most of our listeners are familiar with Continental Motors, but Max West, maybe can you tell us a little bit about Continental and the role they play in aviation?
Oh, sure. It's a huge role. I mean, if you look at piston aircraft, basically the vast majority of the market is supplied by Continental and Lycoming, based up in Williamsport, Pennsylvania. And then you've got a really small fraction of the market, mostly light sport with Rotax engines and things like that. So, yeah, Continental is a huge player. I actually visited their facility down in Mobile, Alabama, maybe six or so years ago. And it was definitely a fun tour to look around and see it. I've visited a lot of different kinds of factories of different types over the years, and this is very different from the kind of electronics things that I've seen in the past. But it was really great fun to walk around, see all the, you know, the massive machines, the different parts, how they all bring it together. But this is a great employer for Mobile, and I'm sure the expansion is going to be, you know, really good locally for everybody involved. Now, the funny thing, of course, to mention is that they were purchased by a Chinese holding company, about 6 years ago. So even though they're based here in the U.S., they're no longer a U.S. company.
Right. They were purchased by AVIC in, I think, 2010. As you mentioned, AVIC is the Chinese holding company, Aviation Industry Corporation. Let's forget the AVIC of China, a state-owned aerospace and defense company. They have a lot of different product, a lot of different aircraft and so forth. Of course, they bought Continental, and also they purchased Cirrus in 2011. Continental is saying that this expansion is really possible because of the purchase by AVIC and the ability for them to sort of fund this kind of expansion. So I think that's it's kind of a trend that we've been seeing in general aviation. And as we know, China is really, really eager to expand their own domestic aviation industry, both general and commercial. So, it kind of makes sense for AVIC to be making these sort of investments, I guess.
Yeah,
but isn't it interesting that they've decided they're not going to build a factory in China?
Well, it might be just yet.
Exactly.
Yeah, I don't think they're going to build, a factory in China until aviation really takes off in China, but they're certainly learning and understanding and could create a factory very quickly, to support Chinese demand.
Hmm. Yeah, good point.
Well, and the other thing is you look at, the weight and size of these objects. It's certainly easy to ship iPhones from China to here. You look at an engine that weighs hundreds of pounds, suddenly your shipping costs become huge compared to the cost of the product itself. So I think it makes sense to continue to build, very heavy items close to where your markets are. Matt's absolutely right. The commercial side of the market has just really taken off in China. But the GA side, as much as there have been predictions, it just is very slow to grow. So who knows if it's going to finally explode and take off. We all hope that it will. Hope that it will.
Again, we're speaking with Matt Desch, the CEO of Iridium. Matt, again, welcome to the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Great to be with you guys. Thanks.
Rob, do you want to kind of kick it off?
This is my seaplane training partner that we have back with us tonight. And what I'm amazed at is that besides being a man who understands rocket science now probably much better than he did just a few years ago, despite the fact that we had him on before, he actually came back.
You didn't completely scare me away.
No, so time. Welcome back, Matt.
Yeah, great to be back with you guys. Thanks.
And I can't wait to hear. Max. I knew this was going to be a problem. Can we call somebody Fred just to make it easy on me?
No, it wouldn't be as fun.
Yeah, I know. So, but maybe everybody out there doesn't really know what Iridium is and how the Iridium Next is kind of poised to take some of our aviation system to the next. Next point in space. Maybe you could talk just a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, first of all, just a primer. Iridium is the world's largest satellite constellation. We have 66 operational satellites flying in low Earth orbit. Low is about 485 miles, about 780 kilometers for our international listeners. So each satellite goes around the Earth. These things are going at 17,000 miles an hour. It goes around the Earth about 14 times a day. Or if you're standing in one place on the Earth or flying, a new satellite will come into view about every 8 to 12 minutes, depending upon where it is in relationship to you. So those satellites have been flying for almost 20 years. As of May, was our first launch in 1997. So they're getting old. Satellites usually last at most about 15 to 20 years, and they need to be replaced. We did embark about 7 years or so ago on a replacement program, which we call Iridium Next. We're going to replace every one of those satellites with brand new satellites. We're building 81 satellites. We're launching 75 of them. So we're replacing 66 satellites, plus having 9 additional spares will be in orbit. They're all being launched on SpaceX rockets, SpaceX Falcon 9 rockets from the West Coast. And that replacement, which started with the first launch on January 14th, will be, we're going to have 8 launches between then and the middle of 2018, and that will replace the whole network.
Now, that first launch in January, that put, what, Matt, 10 satellites into orbit?
That's right. We carry, SpaceX carries 10 satellites on each launch. We do have one launch next year, which we call a rideshare launch, which we're sharing. We're going to have 5 satellites on that one, and NASA and the German Space Agency will carry 2 satellites with it. So that's how the math works out to 75 launches. But that's a lot of launches over a very short period of time. We're almost 25% or more of SpaceX's complete manifest this year. Five launches in 1 year is extraordinary. So it's a lot of satellites to launch, but we're really excited about the potential of what they're going to do for us going forward and the many years of service they're going to give our customers.
Yeah, we really want to get to what the satellites will be doing, the service they'll be providing. But I just have a quick question because I'm curious. When a rocket like this puts 10 into orbit, how does that work? Does the rocket just kind of dump them in space and then they independently navigate themselves to the proper orbit? Or does the SpaceX rocket deploy them, you know, sequentially? How does that work?
Our 10 satellites are mounted on sort of two tiers on the top layer of the satellite that's surrounded by a fairing, you know, sort of a composite structure that blows away as soon as it's above the atmosphere. So those 10 satellites, which are almost about 18,000 pounds, each one's about the size of a Mini Cooper car for those sort of, with its wings deployed, is about the size of a cutoff Cessna 172.
Wow.
But they're all tightly deployed around this big spherical structure that sits on the top of the rocket. The rocket, when it blasts off, its booster boosts it up to about 39, 40 miles or so above, and then it separates. And of course, people love watching the SpaceX boosters land on either land or on barges in the ocean because they're going to reuse a lot of those first stages. But the second stage then lights. It's the one that carries our rockets, and it then burns for another, 10 minutes or so, and then cuts off, and the rocket continues to climb, in our case, up to an altitude of about 350 miles or so, at which point there's a small burn that sort of rounds out the orbit, and that all takes about an hour or so. And the rocket is about halfway around the Earth. At that time, you know, the second stage then sort of points itself up towards the Earth and starts a slow rotation and deploys our satellites one by one about every minute and a half or so. Hmm. And each of these satellites are kind of mounted on there with springs and some pyro blows and pushes this each of the satellites gently away from the booster one by one until all 10 are deployed. Each as they're deployed kind of has a little pin that tells it it's in space and to boot itself up, and at which point it starts itself up, it unfurls its solar panels, it points them towards the sun, and it orients itself towards the ground, starts looking for stars, looking for ways to orient itself to Earth, and then starts talking to the Earth to try to phone home, if you will, to get its instructions, at which point that about 15, 20 minutes later, as they're coming over Norway, we picked them all up. In fact, on January 14th, we picked all 10 of them up as they were all starting operations. So they sort of fly in a loose formation until our operations center in Virginia sort of takes control of them and starts sending commands to them to move into position where we need them to operate.
Hmm. Wow, that's fascinating.
So is that hydrazine propellant that you're using? And are you starting to run out of that in some of the current satellites?
Great question. Yes, it is hydrazine, which is really nasty stuff. So you got to handle it very, very carefully. You can't even breathe the stuff. They have to fuel your satellites with big hazmat suits and everything. The ones that are in space and have been there for 20 years, most of them have a lot of fuel still. Motorola was real smart. They really filled up the gas tanks, not knowing for sure how long they'd be in service. They were really only expected to last about 6 to 9 years. And here we are 20 years later. It doesn't use a lot of fuel to station keep, but what we really want to do is once we replace them, and we're doing that one by one right now, as we're talking here, we have three satellites are now in full operation, and another five will go into operation over the next few days. Each of those satellites, as they replace an existing satellite, we use all the fuel that's left over to deboost them and put them into an orbit at which they should burn up in the atmosphere sometime over the coming months, you know, certainly less than a year for most of them.
That's great. So you've got a green program. You're not going to leave any junk in space.
That's certainly the plan anyway. Yes, they should completely burn up in the atmosphere.
Mm, that's great.
But of course, now the Iridium Next system is going to have something on board that's going to be pretty interesting, I think, to aviators, isn't it?
Well, it's got a couple things, actually. You know, the new satellites are much more powerful and capable than the old satellites, a lot more capacity. The first thing that they provide is a lot more speed. So today we're limited to a very low data rate because of the design from the 1990s. The new satellites will allow radios to be put on airplanes that will go hundreds of kilobits per second, really up to 1.4 megabits ultimately, which will really provide a very effective data service back and forth that can be safety certified, et cetera, and can provide a lot of exciting cockpit services going beyond what we can even do today. But I think what you're alluding to is a very unique payload, is something we call a hosted payload that we have put on the satellite in conjunction with a number of investors. Those are air navigation service providers like Nav Canada, and ENAV, Navier, the Irish Aviation Authority. They're all co-owners with us of this unique service, which will listen for ADS-B signals from space, and it will relay them in real time, second by second, from all the airplanes under all the satellites to air traffic controllers, allowing better air service, allowing more direct routes, faster climbs, better safety, obviously, in the fact that you can see all the airplanes. And we've actually turned the payload on those first three satellites. The ability for those to see every airplane has really been exciting. It's been better than we expected. They're seeing airplanes literally thousands of miles away from each satellite, which is pretty extraordinary when you think that's not how ADS-B was really designed. It was really designed to be sent to towers on the ground, but you know, these receivers that we have on each of our satellites are going to be very, very sensitive and can pick up every, certainly commercial aircraft flying, overseas in oceanic territory, over remote areas, over the poles, and that will just provide a so much better visibility, really, than anyone has today to all the aircraft in the world.
Would that have prevented the problems we've had with MH370?
Well, it certainly would have helped a lot. Assuming that it was broadcasting ADS-B, which I think it had on board, even though it was far away from any ground system to pick it up at the time, we would have been able to see that airplane literally second by second. If you can see an airplane within seconds of when the box stops terminating, then you can really shorten your search area to miles instead of, thousands or hundreds of thousands of square kilometers. So sure, that's going to be better for finding the black box, finding the passengers, hopefully rescuing passengers. But that's not really the reason why we're doing it. It's a great byproduct of it. And our partner FlightAware, which a lot of us use, I'm sure, is going to supply that service to airlines. They all really want to be able to know where every one of their airliners is around the world in real time. And that's a service that that they can now get through FlightAware from us. So it's not just for the air traffic controllers, but it could be for other interested parties as well who need to know that information just to be more efficient.
We see the Iridium Certus products. Is that what we're talking about here, or is that something different?
Yeah, we call it Iridium Certus is the brand name for the higher speed broadband product. That's the first thing I talked about. That was the that's going to be boxes supplied by some of our equipment avionics manufacturers that we've licensed to supply the service, which will allow, connections to aircraft very cost effectively anywhere in the world for thousands of dollars instead of hundreds of thousands of dollars. And then the service I was talking about for ADS-B, that is a service called Aireon, A-I-R-E-O-N. It's a new company that's been formed to supply that service to all the air navigation service providers around the world. They already have a long list of customers. I think they're currently are working with something representing over 30% of the airspace of the world right now. Hmm. So when that service goes into operation, when all the satellites are available in 2018, those air traffic control agencies or air navigation service providers, as they're called, will start using that data to supply better service. Probably the fastest place it'll be used is in the North Atlantic, which is some of the busiest international airspace. That airspace is already planned to be completely covered right now through the providers of service in that in those regions. But a number of other places around the world are also looking to deploy the capability in their remote airspaces as well.
You know, Matt, when this gets or as this gets going, will some of the service providers be starting service using what is up and running, or are you going to wait until you get the entire constellation in place and tested and all that sort of thing before anything starts?
No, we really want to be in live operation supplying better air aviation services in middle 2018 when the network is complete. So they're in testing right now. All our initial customers have connections to the data. They're seeing the data in their own regions right now. In fact, there's flight testing going on. Nav Canada is flight tested. The FAA is doing flight testing actually next week. We've even had a Bonanza flying around with ADS-B out on it all over, just validating that everything is very accurate. And in fact, it is. So no, we want to see it in live operation next year. It will really take, you know, today I realize that radar maybe serves 30% or less of the planet today, mostly where land is, but 70% of the world is not surveilled, as it's called. You know, there is no surveillance in that 70% of the earth. But as of middle of 2018, that will jump to 100% with Aryan service via the Iridium satellite. So so that's really exciting. That really changes the way we see airplanes and, you know, provide safe, efficient service for air traffic around the world.
Does that ADS-B scale down to smaller aircraft? I'm thinking about unmanned aircraft, primarily commercial, not so much hobby use. But if Amazon Prime Air deploys a fleet of drones, would they be able to use ADS-B?
Very, very, very likely. I mean, we're going to be doing testing on capacity and sensitivity. If it's got the right power level and it is broadcasting at 1090, which is the frequency that you know, the international frequency it picks up, very likely that all those will be picked up in real time from the satellite that's overhead. It could support drones. Now, if there are a million or a billion of them, those might overwhelm the ground-based towers, much less us. So we'll see how that all really operates. But I expect that ADS-B would be more used for, you know, non-line of sight, not for every drone everywhere.
Sure, sure. Yeah, that makes sense. What's the power requirement in order to for the signal to reach the satellite?
Well, it's the same requirements that any corporate or commercial airliner has to apply. You know, it's typically something like 250 watts, but there's a wide variety of power levels that can be supplied. You'd expect that there'd be an antenna on top of the aircraft. Some only have it on the bottoms, but that's an international requirement for aircraft flying, say, over oceanic territories anyway, is to have an antenna on the top. But I expect we'll be picking up a lot of aircraft, even with the antenna on the bottom, given how sensitive our system is.
Mm. Just going back to SpaceX a bit, that being a relatively new commercial operation, did you see that as a big risk? How has it turned out working with SpaceX?
Yeah, when we were putting the Iridium Next plan together back in 2008 and 2009, SpaceX really hadn't had a successful launch, but everything we saw from them was that they were doing all the right things. They had the right people, really seemed to have the commitment to do it. And we were pretty comfortable that they would be successful by the time we got around to needing them in 2016, 2017. So it wasn't as much of a risk as you might think. It also wasn't a risk because the bill that Elon gave us was something on the order of $450 million to launch our seven, at that time, launches. We've since added an eighth. I think the next closest offer we got was for $1.2 billion. Mm-hmm. So you can see really what the state of the industry was in terms of how expensive it is to get satellites into space in the traditional way, and really what SpaceX did coming in you know, changing sort of the rules and changing the pricing, it's made a lot more business cases viable for putting satellites in the air. And there's actually sort of a resurgence right now. So it feels a little bit like the 90s again, with thousands of potential LEO satellites on the books right now to be launched over the coming 5 to 8 years. Even SpaceX is thinking of launching a complete network of satellites. So a lot of people are calling this new space or space 2.0, but it really, in part, is due to much lower launch costs. Also smaller satellites and more standard parts and satellites. So, you know, the costs are coming down to get into space. But really, SpaceX has been a big disruptor of the industry. And with their success and their being able to reuse launch components and that sort of thing, they really are going to get a big piece of the market going forward if they continue the kind of success that they've shown so far in their first 30 launches.
I can imagine the SpaceX employees must be just really wildly enthusiastic about what they're doing. Is that kind of the mood at that company?
Yeah, it's a Silicon Valley startup. You know, Elon has created a very dynamic, driven culture. These are the best of the best who are excited about doing something that's never been done before. There's a lot of energy and enthusiasm. We love working with them because we're small and entrepreneurial too, and you know, our cultures fit a lot. And they're a very can-do kind of group. The launch industry for the last 50 years or so has been primarily driven by governments using exotic components. You know, really, you wouldn't call it best practices in the way that they really design rockets. And SpaceX has come in and kind of changed all that, and you know it. And it's really been exciting to work with that because it's fit our needs very well. So.
And has Elon Musk taken you out to dinner yet?
we've been together a number of times. In fact, this first launch was quite exciting. January 14th was a return to flight. You might remember last September they had a fueling incident at yes. Cape Canaveral and a major explosion. So a lot of media attention, a lot of excitement, and I'm sure it was nerve-wracking enough for me. I can't imagine what it was like for Elon. He looked quite tired when I saw him after the launch, and I appreciate him spending some time with those of us that were around there. But he's really doing an awful lot, and of course he runs multiple companies, so he's a very busy guy.
Sure, I imagine. Yeah,
but a lot of fun to be around. Wicked smart and very funny and you know, very driven and fascinating guy to talk to because he really understands his business. He understands the technologies. Wish I could get him flying again. I know he got a pilot's license a while ago, and we'd all love to see him get back in the air, but I think he's a little bit too valuable as the CEO of multiple companies to probably to be spending much time in the air anymore. But I got to keep pushing him to get back in the air and fly again.
Now, you're a pilot yourself, but you're also on the board of trustees for AOPA. Tell us a little bit about what the board of AOPA does.
Yeah, I mean, we're responsible really for ensuring that AOPA is run appropriately for its members, is successful, is able to accomplish its mission, which is protecting our freedom to fly. And while none of us make anything for it, it's a bit of a labor of love. There's a lot of experience on the board, a lot of business experience, a lot of, one of the requirements is you really can't be, business can't be in the aviation industry. So, most of us come from other businesses, but we are all longtime pilots, passionate about aviation. I'm fortunate that I have a small part of my business is focused on aviation, so I kind of get to do both. But it's been fun. I've been flying for 43 years now, and in the 90s when I finally could contribute, I started trying to find out ways that I could help, and I wrote a few checks to the foundation. I really got involved with the Air Safety Foundation because I really wanted to see ensure that it was safe to fly and that others would that safety would improve, and kind of found myself getting more and more involved and found myself on the board, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, and it's been fun. It's a great group, and I'm really pleased how, you know, the direction that AOPA is going in now, you know, particularly focused on trying to grow the pilot population. You know, the UCAN Fly program is very important. We just talked about a concern about airplanes and buying airplanes. We need more pilots. You know, we need more people to fly them. We need to tackle all the issues associated with that create problems for that. And I think that's what AOPA is about. It's a very important organization on behalf of all of us to do that.
Yeah, kind of coincidentally, well, maybe not kind of, maybe totally coincidentally, our guest last episode was Mark Baker, of course, the president of AOPA. And a few weeks ago, we had Kat Swain on the UAV Digest podcast, and she was talking about the AOPA initiatives to embrace drone pilots as well. So actually, we've been giving AOPA a lot of good press lately. There's a lot of good activities going on, and there's a lot of good advocacy that AOPA has been involved in these days.
Well, you know, it's really important. Aviation is under attack in under many ways, not just in the natural decline because of higher costs and technical issues and you know, airspace issues, but you know, if we don't have someone on our side ensuring that aviation is protected, that airports are protected, that that flying can be done safely. I mean, the basic med, I'm sure Mark talked about, was a big win for us. It helps allow us to fly a little longer. It won't be long before I may need that. So I think we all are thankful for the efforts that that they undertook on our behalf. So it's an important organization. I hope everybody listening is a member, because I think there's a lot of information and education, and you'd be supporting the industry as well by being a part of it.
Yes, every time this topic comes up, I always point out that I'm not an aircraft owner and I'm not a pilot, but for a number of years I've belonged to AOPA because I support the activities that AOPA undertakes, and the way they promote aviation. It's an important thing to do, important to give them their support. So, yeah, you don't have to be a pilot to join.
No. In fact, a surprisingly large part of our membership just loves aviation and loves the magazine, loves the online access, loves the and by the way, whether you're a member or not, I hope people are going online to the Air Safety Foundation part of the AOPA website and watching all the videos. There's just a lot of content that will help get you closer to aviation. But certainly, it's great for everyone who's got any kind of interest in aviation.
Absolutely.
We can't possibly not talk about airplanes. I mean, yeah. I kind of, you know, tipped our hat a little bit that Matt and I earned our seaplane rating a couple of years ago. And Matt, have you been able to use your seaplane rating since then?
Yes, and I want to tell everyone, Rob taught me everything I know about seaplanes.
Okay. Well, Max Trescott is also a seaplane instructor, he knows just how little I know about it.
Yes, well, that's the
point. But it was fun.
No, everybody should get, anyone who's a pilot should get their seaplane rating. That's probably the easiest and most fun rating to get, and probably the least useful initially for most people, because unless you plan on buying a seaplane, not many people rent them to you. So it's not something maybe immediately useful, but I can tell you I certainly learned a lot, and I think it helps flying otherwise. But no, I haven't bought a seaplane. Putting floats on the airplane I just bought would be a real challenge, I think. I don't think anyone is going to be able to get an STC for that. So.
Well, what are you flying these days?
Well, I had a Turbo 210, I think the last time we talked, a Cessna 210, and I finally took the plunge and bought a very early model TBM. In fact, Mark Baker's just bought one, two serial numbers different from mine, so we got an early model, A model of a TBM 700, and that's been great for the last 2 or 3 years and has really changed the utility of my flying. And then, as I think I told you a little earlier, I may have lost my mind, but we've ordered a brand new TBM 900 here that hopefully will come later this year, and kind of excited about, you know, the potential for even more speed. And it's a great airplane. It's just such a perfect mix between speed, utility, and being able to still use small airfields and operating efficiency. It's been a fantastic airplane. I'm not employed by Daher, I might say. But I think a lot, it's the one, as you said, bright spot in the airframe manufacturing has been turbine. I think TBM has made up a little bit of that, you know, and some others, because just the step up that a lot of private pilots, I think, are making into turbine, low-end turbine. Especially some of the ones, like the early TBM models from 20, 25 years ago are just a little bit more than a new Cirrus, so they're not that out of the reach of many private pilots to consider stepping up to.
That's a single engine turboprop. Is that a Pratt Canada? Is that a PT6?
It is. It's a PT6, 64, the older ones, and the 66, the newer ones. It's 750 shaft horsepower in the early ones, and that's been sort of upgraded to 850. So they're, you know, the new ones are 330 knot airplanes at 31,000 feet. So it's a really great performing airplane, almost jet speeds, but at not the costs of fuel that you have to with small jets.
Very nice. They're good looking too. Very nice lines.
They are.
Can I just ask one real quick question?
Yes.
Okay. Matt, when is the next launch for the next group of satellites?
Yeah, so our next launch is scheduled for middle of June. We currently have a date of June 17th with a backup of the 18th, and I'm expecting that to be pulled pretty close to that. And then we have a launch later on in August, another one in October, one near Christmas, and then three more in 2018. So a lot of launches, all from California, and really excited to get those 75 satellites up there.
Wow.
Cool. One very last question, Matt. Are the new satellites going to produce iridium flares like the old ones?
You know, I get asked that question an awful lot.
Oh, do you really?
Probably more than any of my social media followers to Iridium Boss online keep asking that, especially the space-oriented ones. Yeah, I mean, for those who don't know, the current satellites exhibit at certain times of the early evening or late morning, a very, very bright light off of them that you can see on the ground. In fact, there's apps that you can get for your iPhone or Android phone to tell you exactly when they're going to occur in your GPS location. They're quite fun to see. It's great to show the grandkids that you are that you know what you're talking about, to be able to point in the sky and say, look in 10 seconds and see it exactly show up on time. And it's the brightest thing in the sky when it happens. That occurs because we have this bright, giant 45-degree angled antennas on the current satellites that about 8 feet long, and they're really shiny. And unfortunately, the new satellites don't have any shiny bits on them like that. And I just didn't think it was worth spending millions of dollars to just replace that phenomenon. So if you do enjoy flares or taking pictures of them, you got about three or four more years to see them before all of those current satellites are deorbited. But unfortunately, that's not going to be a phenomenon that will continue in the Iridium Next era.
Oh, dear. Well, I hate to end on a sad note. So instead, I'll mention that something that I wasn't aware of when I was looking at the Iridium website, which, of course, is iridium.com, is that you actually have an online store where you can buy T-shirts and patches and hats and stickers and that sort of stuff. I'm a sucker for that. So you may see an order for some T-shirts come through for
me.
Well,
great. That's a pretty new thing for us. A lot of people are excited once they are in the middle of nowhere and they use their Iridium Go or Iridium satellite phone or have from their airplane and they want to participate in that in a bigger way. But more importantly, there is a lot of people excited about launches, you know, that are just excited about space. And, you know, of course, you have to have patches and pins and all kinds of things associated with each launch. So each one of them has a unique logo and patch and pin. So a lot of people are collecting those things, and I'm sure will look like Oshkosh as they walk around with their patches all over their jackets. You know?
Oh, very good. Well, you can find that on the Iridium website, as I mentioned. But we're also going to have some links to some of these things we've been talking about in our show notes. You can find those at airplanegeeks.com/445. So Matt Desch, CEO of Iridium Communications, thanks again for joining us on the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Always great to be with you guys. Thanks for having me.
Hey, thanks, Matt.
Thanks, Rob. All right.
Great to talk with you again.
All right, let's do a little bit of what's up with the geeks. Rob, where are you headed to next week?
I'm going to Disney World. No, I'm not. I am going to Florida, though. Next week is the annual Sun and Fun event down in Florida. And, of course, flying's going to be down there with three or four or five or six of us, I think. And so we're looking forward to seeing all the cool stuff that's going on down there, meeting a few folks, and who knows what kind of trouble we'll get into.
Oh, that sounds great. Max T, you got anything new?
You know, it's pretty much the same old, same old. I was just flipping back through my iPhone to see, what did I do this last week? So, you know, all kinds of pictures and stuff like that. But now lots of flying. Things were a little bit slow over the winter months, and now it's picking up a little bit. I was up this morning and shot some fun pictures over Livermore, California. It's incredibly green out here right now. It kind of looks like Ireland. So it's lovely. We've had so much rain that what are usually kind of brownish hills in the summertime have totally turned just beautiful green. So I was up shooting pictures today of kind of a mix of clouds left over from the last storm and the beautiful green scenery here. So just having fun out here on the West Coast.
Was that your photo, your nighttime photo that showed up in our Instagram account?
Yes, I did.
That was gorgeous. Oh, that was amazing. It was the city lights below, as I recall, reflected off the underside of the wing, the high wing.
That was, I wasn't sure which picture it was. Yes, now I remember that. That was pretty amazing because you could almost turn that night picture upside down and get the same image because the reflection off the underside of the wing was so good. So, yeah, it's, you know, when I got a lot of night flying in over the last 2-3 weeks because I was trying to get it done prior to daylight saving time because that way we can, you know, get the students' required nighttime done without having to, you know, start at 9 o'clock at night and finish at midnight.
All right. As for me, we recorded episode 44 of the PaxX podcast last week. We had John Walton, we being Mary Kirby, of course, and myself. Our guest was John Walton. He is a travel expert. He knows aircraft interiors like nobody else. This guy is just got so much knowledge. Just a really great conversation with him. But we talked about the laptop ban. We talked about problems with the Zodiac seats on the Cathay Pacific A350-900s and also talked a little bit about what to expect at the Aircraft Interiors Expo that's taking place in Hamburg really quick here, April 4th through 6th, 2017. So check out the PaxX podcast for episode 44 for all of that. One shout out I'd like to make. This is an Indiegogo project. Now, normally I don't like promoting Indiegogo projects, Kickstarter projects, things like that, because, well, there is some risk and I don't have any way to really personally vet the project leaders. However, once in a while something comes along and you say, oh, this sounds really good. This is called Fly Like a Girl. It's a documentary film. They say that this film is going to explore the courageous history of women in aviation. It's a full-length documentary. It says it's going to reveal the contributions women have made to aviation and brings to light the many women who are doing extraordinary work in aviation and STEM today. Fly Like a Girl also examines why many young girls don't see themselves in aviation or STEM-related fields and how society can begin to change this perception. And this is the tagline I like. Fly Like a Girl will inspire girls and women who no longer want to be passengers. So we'll put a link to this Indiegogo site in the show notes. Take a look at it. It just really sounds like a good thing to do, a good thing to support. So, but of course, that's up to you. And I assume that this will work out as well as I know many of us hope it will. Now let's move on to some listener mail. We heard from Jeff. Now, you might remember listener Mark wrote us. We talked about his email in episode 443. He had heard two airliners flying overhead, and what caught his attention was that the sound of the engines was different than usual. He said the sound was roughly the same volume, but seemed somehow lower in pitch and somehow muted, and it didn't change as they passed over. He's wondering if weather conditions could have caused the change in sound or maybe something else. Well, one of our listeners, Jeff, decided to take it upon himself to kind of look into this. Jeff's a retired Air Force meteorologist, and he also was an instructor teaching new troops about forecasting Alaska weather, which is where this little thing occurred. So Jeff says that he, looking at all the evidence, the mystery aircraft was a FedEx MD-11F Flight 22 to Indianapolis on the KNIT-2 departure, having departed 2 minutes after Alaska Airlines Flight 98, which was a Boeing 737-900 going to Seattle. And then he actually was able to identify the passes that both of these aircraft took to the observer, which would be Mark. So the 737 was at an altitude of 3,200 feet, true distance 3,620 feet. Meanwhile, the MD-11 was at 3,840 feet, true distance 4,480 feet. And Jeff says, in relation to their respective closest passes to the observer, the 737 was just below and beginning to pass through a temperature inversion at 3,641 feet, while the MD-11 was already above this inversion. The MD-11 was climbing at a higher rate per minute than the 737, that being 1,500 feet per minute versus 1,100 feet per minute for the 737. Now, he continues, the engines of the 737-900 are slightly quieter than on the MD-11F. They might be like a lot quieter, actually. But anyway, he says the meteorological conditions, mean takeoff weight, engine settings, and distance and height differences all could have contributed to the perceived quieter MD-11F noise performance on its departure. And then Jeff also gave us a number of files that show where he got this information from. So I don't know. I think this is maybe this is easier than it seems to me, just because I don't know how to do all that. But just the fact that you can, you know, start off with someone's observations who tells you when they or where they were and when they were and what they heard or what they saw. And Jeff was able to identify all this information and look at the weather conditions and so forth. I think it's just amazing. I don't know. Is that just because I'm a simple kind of a guy?
No.
I don't know. I mean, I guess I didn't realize exactly what you were looking for, because if I had jumped in on time, I mean, I was going to say what you just said, whatever that was.
Now, I got to tell you, I was not surprised in the least, because we have the smartest listeners. In fact, right now, I'm thinking they may be smarter than the co-hosts. That's what I'm thinking. Now, this is really just an amazing analysis that he's gone through. So I think Jeff could, you know, he should be looking at a career on CSI. His forensics here were really excellent.
Yeah. Maybe we should get Jeff on the show. He can explain to us all this magic analysis that he's able to perform. And tell us something about the Alaska weather and what that means for flying in Alaska. Maybe Jeff be good for that. Jeff, I know you're listening. Let's talk, guy. We also heard from Mick, and he sent us another great video. This is called Crawl Through a B-29 Super Fortress in Flight. And there's some subtitles to this. But basically what we have here is Fifi, the B-29, and Flight Chops here has really completely documented a flight on the B-29 from the inside with a number of GoPros that were positioned around. And you get to see this thing flying, you know, as it's flying in the air. You get to crawl through the tube. You get to, you know, see both ends of the pressurized sections of the aircraft. And it is just fascinating. If you have seen the Fifi films or seen it flying, it's not the same as getting a view from the inside. So good job, Mick, on spotting this video and sending it along. We'll have a link to that one in the show notes. And then Patrick wrote in, Utah Patrick. This is an article from electric.co. Electric plane startup steps out of stealth mode to announce plan for a 150-seat battery-powered plane. 150 seats. So there's this startup, Wright Electric, which is Wright spelled like the guys who almost started this whole thing, other than the guy in Connecticut. And what Wright Electric wants to do is build this 150-seat aircraft. They're looking at short-haul flights under 300 miles. And I imagine that's because of the the capacity of the batteries to power this thing. But interestingly, their idea is not to develop the complete aircraft, including the batteries. What they want to do is they want to develop an airplane and then let others who are specialists or experts in battery technology do that part of it and then sort of slip that into the plane. It's kind of an interesting spin on how I think airplanes are usually designed. So think of it as Wright Electric will develop this airplane, and then as battery technology improves, you'll be able to implement that into the aircraft. So, I don't know, interesting. You know, guys, electric power just keeps showing up everywhere these days in aviation.
Yeah, I think it's really... Go ahead, Trump.
Oh, I was going to say, and I remember, I don't know how long ago it was, but I was up at Air Venture when, you remember Jeremy Monet from Sonics Aircraft, and Jeremy, yeah. We lost him a couple of years ago in an aircraft accident, but I remember Jeremy and his crew were first starting to look at ways to power small aircraft with electric motors, and people said, oh, nobody's ever going to use an electric motor in an airplane. You'll never be able to get the batteries to carry. And it's funny, if Jeremy were here watching, I bet he'd be really amazed at how this is taken off.
Yeah. Yeah, it's working really, really great for small aircraft. I think it was probably around 2011, 2012, I watched an ultralight at Oshkosh fly for, I don't know, probably 40 minutes or something like that. And I really think the electric power is going to help out tremendously, especially in the low end of general aviation. If we can get a trainer where you can get a couple of hours on a charge and then be able to either recharge rapidly or swap the batteries relatively quickly, that could dramatically reduce the cost of flight training, which could really open it up to a lot of other people. But I got to say, I'm just slightly skeptical. As much as I believe that will happen at the low end, 150 people, that's a lot of an airplane to be driven by batteries. And I kind of worry that this may be driven on perhaps an overly optimistic scenario of how rapidly battery technology is going to go along. You know, battery technology has just been slowly, slowly getting better for decades. Everybody keeps waiting for the big breakthrough where, you know, the battery power density will increase by, you know, 10% of a year instead of 1 or 2% a year. They may have a lot of these airplanes sitting around on the ground waiting for their batteries to show up.
Yeah, but, you know, it is interesting that they're saying, look, we don't know enough about batteries to dive into that, and we're going to let somebody else partner with us. And who knows, maybe that is the opportunity that some battery company, except, of course, for the people that built the batteries for the galaxies, but galaxy phones, they probably wouldn't be in the running.
I hope not. Oh dear.
And if they do, just make sure we check those in the baggage. You know, we don't want those in the carry-on.
That's right. Oh dear. Well, you know, when it comes to batteries, the sort of the king of high density batteries these days is Elon Musk through his Tesla organization. And there's a really interesting kind of comment in this article, because Elon Musk, of course, who's sort of played with, I don't know about played with, but has a design for a vertical takeoff electric plane, he says that these kind of systems become possible once battery energy density reaches over 400 watt hours per kilogram. And then in the article, they say that it's believed that the Tesla vehicles that are powered by battery cells, of course, are in the 250 watt hour per kilogram range. So, yeah, there is quite a bit of development that needs to take place.
Yeah, and if you're improving by a couple percent a year, it's going to take a long time to get from 250 to 400. So hopefully they'll find some kind of breakthrough at some point.
Now, one final comment on that. If you're interested in this and interested in Wright Electric, I notice on the website, they have a blog that you can click through to, and they post weekly updates. A lot of times when you hear about these companies developing this, you know, amazing stuff or the stuff that sounds amazing, there's the announcement and then there's not much information that comes out for quite a period of time. But these folks are posting weekly what's happening. And I think that's kind of unique. You can also sign up for an email update. I imagine that it's probably the same content as in those blog posts. But if you're interested in following Wright Electric, you might want to do that. We'll have a link to their website in the show notes.
And I may be underestimating battery improvements. I just kind of looked up quickly, and I guess at least in the lithium ion area, annual improvement rates have been close to 8%, though a lot of people think that's going to drop off and, you know, maybe get down to 5%. So I guess it's moving along faster than I thought, so that's good.
That is good. Well, you've heard reports from our Airplane Geeks reporter at large, Launchpad Marzari, and he's come through with some more. This is from the Heart of Texas Air Show that was held March 18th and 19th, 2017 in Waco, Texas. So what we have is a number of short interviews. They're very interesting, and we'll play those for you now. Let's start off with Launchpad talking with the flight engineer for a B-17 named Texas Raider.
This is Launchpad Marzari from the Heart of Texas Air Show, and we're doing this interview from a really cool place. We're in the bomb bay of a B-17, not just any B-17, the Texas Raider B-17, and I'm here with
Laser Dave McConkey, flight engineer.
Full disclosure, I'm a CAF member myself. I belong to the B-29 squadron, which is just up the street from you because you're located in...
We have just moved to Conroe, Texas at General Aviation Services.
Cool. Now, the part that, outside of being just a really cool airplane, the neat part about Texas Raiders is...
So many different things. It would take a while to tell you. This is a fully restored B-17G, the most accurately restored B-17, out of what we think is about 9 left flying. We have a brand new paint job. This is the debut of our new paint job, our new nose art, done by the very famous and talented Gary Velasco. And right now, we've got one of the most gorgeous B-17s on Earth, period.
And not only that, but we can go for a ride.
You can indeed. You cannot. This is a plane that you can come up and touch and feel and smell and tour inside and bonk your head and get a little oil on you. And if you're so inclined, you can take what we call a living history flight experience for a bit of money, mostly tax deductible, I must point out. And then you can really get a sense for what it was like back in the day and get a fly in this marvelous warbird. And nobody gets off without a big grin on their face.
That's it. And that's what's different about this air show or about your airplane at an air show is that we can go for a ride. And that's the exciting part. And if they want to know about your schedule, where would they go look?
They would look on our website, which is gulfcoastwing.org. Our schedule for the summer is still developing. It's a pretty dynamic thing in the warbird industry. Next weekend, this coming weekend, we are back at our old home, which is Hooks Airport at Gill Aviation, Saturday only. That's in near Tomball, Texas. And the week after that, we're at our new home for an open house, and that's in Conroe at General Aviation Services, and we'll be there Saturday only. And after that, I believe we're going into Florida.
Well, your paint job is gorgeous. There's nothing short about gorgeous on this airplane. All right, we're going to keep moving on here. We'd like to thank you and the B-17 Texas Raider. This is Launchpad Marzari, frequency change approved. Good day.
Next up, Launchpad talks with Nick Bearshark Green. He's from the F-18 demo team.
This is Launchpad Marzari coming to you live from the heart of Texas Air Show, and I'm here with
Lieutenant Nick Bearshark Green,
and he's from the Hornet demo team. And tell us what you brought with you.
Today we brought the F-18 Charlie, the Legacy Hornet, out here. Static demo today, just kind of showing with the old paint scheme here, the VFA 15 jet. So it's a little bit of a unique paint scheme on the F-18.
Okay, and you're out here just for a static for this weekend.
Yeah, we're a static for this weekend. Still working some kind of quals, but we should be full up for the rest of our air shows here down the line.
All right, and what's the next two stops for you? Where can people come out and see you?
I think the next one's going to be, at the Tinker Air Show in Enid, Oklahoma. And then after that, I believe we've got a Fort Lauderdale show down in Florida.
Very cool. Now, you know, how much fun is it to get to fly around to all these different private airports and land at FBOs?
I tell you, it's cool. The best part is kind of getting out here and interacting with the public, watching the kids' eyes light up, you know, and they see a big gray jet come in and do all their the cool demonstrations and all the cool maneuvers we do. Everyone always asks, like, kind of how cool is it to fly an F-18, and I tell them, if you ever seen one fly, you think it looks cool, that's how cool it is. You know, it's just like that.
Okay, now tell us the path that you took to get here.
Sure, you bet. So I graduated from college from K-State Salina with a degree in basically professional pilot. From there, I went to OCS in Newport, Rhode Island. Spent about 3 months there training to become an officer in the Navy. After that, I got to flight school, so I went through Pensacola, Florida, like every naval aviator. Went API, did that for a while. And then I went and actually cross-trained with the Air Force in Enid, Oklahoma, flying the T-6 Texan II to get through my primary training there for the Navy. After that, I got decent enough grades to go ahead and select jets, tailhook option at that time. So I went and flew the T-45 Charlie in Kingsville, Texas, where you kind of go through all your intermediate advanced jet training there, instruments, formation, low-level nav, strike, and then some basic kind of BFM fighting stuff there. And then I got selected to fly the F-18 Super Hornet on the East Coast out of Oceana, Virginia, in Virginia Beach, and went there actually to VFA 106 as a student the first time through. Went out of there, selected F-18 Echo, so the single-seat Super Hornet out of VFA 106, and did an operational tour with VFA 105, the Gunslingers, right there in Oceana again. We did one combat deployment there to OEF on the Truman. And then after that tour, I was selected to come back to VFA 106 to be an instructor. So I got to see VFA 106 from both sides of the table. And then at VFA 106, I just kind of I was able to pick up the NMO team. So I'm going through the training right now. And then I'll be kind of doing the air shows for the rest of the season. And then helping train the next lot of guys behind me to do the demo. So that's kind of a short
story. Oh, such a life, yeah, right. Rough life, yeah. To have to fly demos and fly to air shows.
It is a treat.
Okay, so what's the funnest part about getting to come out here?
I would say the best part is probably coming out and actually flying the demo routine. It is not something we get to do every day in the jet, and especially a slick Charlie. As a really good performance, and it's just a really fun routine to fly, and you know, challenging but rewarding to get the actual profile done, and then it's kind of fun to kind of feel like a hero and text in front of the crowd, wave at everybody, come out and sign autographs and high five all the kids. So
very cool. Well, thank you, Bearshark.
You bet.
And this is Launchpad Marzari saying frequency change approved. Good day.
All right, very cool. Next, Launchpad speaks with Greg Howell. Now, he flies a MiG-17. This aircraft was built in 1960 in Poland.
This is Launchpad Marzari here with MiG-17 driver Greg Howell. Say hello, sir.
Hi, how are you?
We're here at the Heart of Texas Air Show, and I'm standing next to this gorgeous MiG-17. Sir, can you tell us a little about the airplane?
Yeah, this airplane was manufactured in January of 1960 in Poland. Came off the assembly line, served in the Polish Air Force for several years, and eventually found its way over to the U.S. probably late 80s, early 90s. And it's changed ownership a few times since before I acquired the airplane about a year ago.
Roger. And now you have to have a type rating to fly this airplane,
yes,
correct?
Yes, you do. I went to Santa Fe, New Mexico, and got my type rating in a MiG-15 because that has two seats. And it's a dual type rating between the 15 and the 17. I can fly either aircraft. All the systems are pretty much identical. There's just a few differences on the 17. Of course, it has the afterburner, which that's a real big hit at the air shows. It's a little bit longer, so it's more stable than the 15. It's got a different wing on it. Those are really the only three major differences between the two aircraft.
What's your normal air show routine like?
Remove before you fly.
Well, right now, I don't have my aerobatic rating, so it just involves, you know, high-speed passes, low-speed passes, tight turns, some climbs and stuff. I'm going to work on my aerobatic rating this year, and then, you know, I can do aileron rolls and, you know, Cuban eights and vertical climbs and stuff like that. We don't get real crazy with it. You know, it's an old airplane. It's very reliable, but, you know, old jet warbirds, you know, they're not as maneuverable as like a extra 300 or something with the guys. Really go crazy, so we don't do that. But we thrill the crowd with the speed and the afterburner and whatnot.
Where are you based out of, sir?
Tyler, Texas.
So this is just a quick hop over for you.
Oh, about a 20-minute flight, yeah.
Wow. That's like half a tank of gas?
Almost. It does burn a lot of fuel. It averages, if you're going from point A to B, it averages between 380 and 400 gallons an hour. So it's pretty much a fuel hog. And, you know, we get about an hour endurance and before we need to land, so we'll have our reserve fuel. So the legs are pretty short on it.
What specifically is a U.S. system that you had to put in the cockpit as opposed to the original Soviet system?
Well, what they had to do when it was certified in the U.S., of course, the airspeed indicator, the VSI, and the altimeter were all in meters and kilometers and that. So to get it certified in the U.S., you had to change it out to U.S. feet and nautical miles per hour. So those are the three instruments that you had to change out. Some other things have been added to it. We put an HSI in it. We got a Garmin 430. A standby ADI, but pretty much everything else is the original. We've got the original ADI attitude indicator. And what's weird about this one on the MiGs, if you look at it, when you first look at it, you think it's upside down because a normal U.S. Attitude indicator has the blue on the top. When you get in this one, the blue's on the bottom, and you go, And it takes some getting used to. It's just the technology they had then. And you know, you still see blue when you're climbing and brown when you're descending. It's just it's reversed.
It's upside down.
Engine instruments and the pressure gauges are all original. And you know, U.S. airplanes pretty much measure everything in PSI, pounds per square inch. The Soviets use atmospheres or kilograms. And so, but it doesn't really matter what the measurement is, as long as you know the number.
Last thing I want to ask you about is talk to me about care and feeding, because this aircraft has a live ejection seat.
It does. Once a year, once the air show season is done, and air show season usually runs between February and November, then we take the airplane back to our maintenance hangar and it spends all winter there. We do our winter maintenance. We pull the tail on it and do a thorough inspection. There's a lot of things that we know at that time that need to be replaced. We'll replace them so it doesn't break down later in the air show season. You know, most of it involves inspection. If we find something that we think needs to be replaced, we'll do that. Ejection seat comes out. We send it off to have it tested. It's got a timer on it. Have the timer tested. And just kind of some routine maintenance, making everything sure.
Okay, so
working.
You have to send it out to get certified. You have to send the ejection seat out to get certified.
Well, we send it to our mechanic that does it for us, or he'll come. Yeah, you know, it's our butt flying in the airplane, so we want to make sure that time of year that everything is as good as possible. So, you know, that nothing happens during the year. And then, you know, we don't want to be in an air show and break down and not be able to perform either.
Did you have to get a rating for an ejection seat?
No, we didn't. It's just
a green card or?
No. You just get approval from the FAA, and they're starting to come out with more training scenarios and training material for the ejection seat, because there's a lot of warbirds out there flying that either have a manual bailout or you have an ejection seat. And especially with ejection seats, the FAA is looking to do some more training, kind of general training with people that may not have had military experience with ejection seats. And so they're looking at it a little bit more, kind of just make sure that everybody's up to speed on it. But so far, up to this point, any specialized training or certificate, no. We just, they know, FAA knows that we have a hot seat. It's in our operating specs, and we're allowed to use it. Hopefully, I never have to use it, though.
Do you have to take any special precautions when locking the plane up at night, or is it just normal, just lock the airplane up? Do you have to notify the airport or the FISDO?
Oh, no. We safety the seat every time when we get done flying, and we just close her up, lock the hangar up and go home.
All right. Well, thank you, sir. We've been talking to MiG-17 driver Greg Howell. Gee, rough job if you can get it. And this is Airplane Geeks reporter at large, Launchpad Marzari.
Thanks, Launchpad. Now we have Launchpad speaking with Jerry Cummings. He's with the Air Refueling Wing, flying a KC-135. He's an air refueling specialist, basically a boom operator. So here's Launchpad and Jerry.
This is Launchpad Marzari, and we're here at the Heart of Texas Air Show. And today we're with
Master Sergeant Jerry Cummings from the 434th Air Refueling Wing, Grissom Air Reserve Base in Indiana.
Very good. And tell us about this cool airplane we're sitting in the lee side of.
Well, this KC-135 that we brought here today in Texas, this particular one was built in 1960. So we're talking, 57 years old or so. She's still flying today. But this aircraft has got air refueling capability. She holds about 180, maybe 185,000 pounds of fuel when she's fully loaded. She was designed back in the Cold War era to refuel the B-52 originally. We could offload every drop of gas out of this aircraft into the B-52 to make sure that the bombers got to their target sites and could release their nuclear bombs.
Okay, cool. And what's your really cool job title?
Well, by the Air Force Specialty Code, I'm a air refueling specialist, otherwise known as a boom operator.
Which is just a really cool flying job.
Yeah, I probably got the best air. I've got the best job in the Air Force when it comes to enlisted jobs, by far.
And as the boom operator, do you have any additional duties when you're in the aircraft?
I do. Although the title kind of represents that we're air refueling specialists, we also take care of the weight and balance of the aircraft and cargo loading and passenger handling when needed.
So you function as a loadmaster?
Basically, yes, with air refueling capabilities.
Got it. What's the coolest aircraft you've gotten to sneak up under your window to give fuel to?
Well, listen, any aircraft that comes up behind you to get gas is pretty cool. But my personal favorite, I always love the F-15. It's got beautiful lines. It's a big aircraft. Loved them as a kid. Love them as an adult.
Okay. Talk to us real quickly about the procedure of the F-15's coming up underneath and he needs gas. How does he get to where he needs to be so you can give him gas?
Well, air refueling is all done about timing. So we show up at a particular point in space over the geographic Earth, and the receiver is going to be there as well. And if the F-15 is there with his wingman, they will come up and meet the tanker, and they're going to come up behind us. Once they stabilize about 50 feet behind us, I will have the boom set up, ready to go. They are going to call that they're stable ready. I will tell them they're cleared to contact. Once they come up, they are going to maneuver in position, and I have the capability to fly the boom around. And once he or she is in the ideal position, then I'm going to establish a contact with that receiver, and then we will continue to pass fuel to them.
Cool. And now, you're the one that, when you've passed the prescribed amount of fuel, you're the one that breaks contact, correct?
That is partially true. The receiver aircraft also has the capability of initiating that disconnect as well.
Is there a SOP of who normally does it first, or you just play it by ear?
You play it by ear. Sometimes you don't even realize that the receiver aircraft has their tanks full. I have no idea. That F-15, I have no idea when their tanks are full, other than they tell us they're full, and then they initiate a disconnect. Sometimes the fighter type guys, they'll just initiate a disconnect, and the boom will just free flow right out of the receptacle, and they'll tell us, peace out, boys, we're out of here.
Okay, cool. Now, once you've flown in and made the connection, it's hands off?
It is not hands off. If ever you look at a KC-135 or a KC-10 at your local air show, take a close look at the boom. You're going to see two black wing-looking type devices on that boom. We call those rudivators. I have a control in the boom pod in which I can move a rudivator control stick around that articulates and moves those rudivators, so I am actually flying that boom around to match what the aircraft behind us is doing.
Got it. Now, what was your path to the Air Force?
I always had a passion to fly early on. My father, you know, like most small kids, they love aircraft. I was that aircraft geek going to air shows and watching airplanes. When I was in high school, I worked at our local airport pumping gas, moving the airplanes, taking care of the rental planes, taking care of all the daily FBO duties at 16 years old. My father began flying when I was 14. I've got my student license when I was 16, my private pilot's license when I was 17, and it just took off from there. I went into active duty Air Force right out of high school. My career started out in air traffic control. Since then, I separated out of active duty, went in the reserves where I was a maintenance crew chief for 7 years, then became a boom operator after that. So after 24 years of service, I'm on my third career in the military as far as a career field. As far as flying privately, I've got a private pilot's license, instrument rating, working on my commercial license now, and spent 6.5 years building a Vans RV9, which I absolutely enjoy flying that airplane. It's got about 550 hours on it right now.
Awesome. Truly an airplane geek, are you?
Absolutely. Absolutely, yes. It's in my blood, and there's something about the aviation community. You go to Oshkosh, you go to Sun and Fun, there is something very, very special about aircraft owners and pilots. Just the way they talk to each other and so forth. It's really a bond, and you can see that when you're at one of those big exhibitions, how well kept the grounds are. I mean, you just take a look at that, and this tells you how much pride pilots have in their aircraft and their craft.
Master Sergeant Cummings, we'd like to thank you for taking the time to talk to us. This is Launchpad Marzari, frequency change approved.
Launchpad also had an opportunity to speak with Captain Philip Fernandez. He flies a V-22 Osprey.
This is Launchpad Marzari, and we're here at the Heart of Texas Air Show and continuing our series of helicopters that don't look like helicopters. I'm here with
Captain Philip Fernandez, United States Marine Corps, with the VMM-166 out of San Diego, California, Marine Corps Air Station Miramar.
And you've brought it's a tilt rotor. It's a V-22. Tell us about this cool-looking aircraft.
It's the V-22 Osprey. Marine Corps had it for approximately 20 years now, operational for about 10. We do assault support, troops and gear, pretty much anywhere they need to, off the ships and on land.
What was your path to getting to fly the V-22?
I went to flight school in Pensacola, Florida, 2 years there. I flew helicopters, the CH-46, for approximately 3 years. The helicopter got retired, and then I've been here as a transition pilot for 3 years. That's all I'm going to fly in it.
And tell us the path that brought you to being a V-22 pilot.
I went to college to be an airline pilot at Metro State College in downtown Denver. I got a professional pilot's license or degree there, and then from there I went to officer candidate school at Quantico, Virginia. Did a 10-week course there for a direct commission. And then from there, I went to basic school, which is infantry training just for all Marine Corps officers. And then from there, I went to flight school at Pensacola, Florida. Flight school, we started with T-34 was our initial training aircraft. So I did approximately 100 hours of flight time there. It's basic instruments, aerobatics, things like that. And then from there, you get split off into your specific aircraft you're going to fly, whether it be rotary, TAC air or jets, cargo airplanes. I got helicopters initially, so I went to fly the TH-57 Jet Ranger, and from there I got selected to fly the CH-46 Echo. Went to Camp Pendleton, California to fly that. Flew that for approximately 3 years. Get to be what's called a fully qualified helicopter second pilot. You do all your basic flying instruments, and then after that you move into the tactical flying, and then from there, since that aircraft got retired, I transitioned over to the V-22 Osprey. Did that in 2014, went to Marine Corps Station New River to learn that aircraft. And that was, I did my simulator flights at Miramar for about 2 months. Then I went to New River for about a month worth of flying. And it's the same type of flying, just initially learning how to fly the aircraft, instruments, getting ATOPS rating, which is just your ability to be qualified in the airplane. And then I came back to Miramar, to my actual squadron, and then started flying the actual tactical side of it, which is our mission subsets, like I talked about, landing on the ship, air-to-air refueling, moving people wherever they need to go, things like that. And I've been doing that for 3 years.
Okay, and as you can hear, we've got a T-28 Trojan flying around because we're doing this live on the flight line, which is no better place to be. Okay, Captain, how many hours do you get a month, and how many do you get a year on this aircraft?
So we're required to get 100 hours a year. We average probably about 200 to 300 hours a year, depending on how much we fly. We would try to get about 20 to 30 hours a month. Lately, we haven't been able to get that, but we'd like to get 20 to 30 is what we'd like to get.
Now, as our name is, the Airplane Geeks, let's get some geeky questions in. You can take the aircraft off as a rolling takeoff with the nacelles bent down at some angle. Talk to me about that. What's your airspeed? What's the nacelles? How does that work?
So we can do a vertical takeoff, which you just take off with the nacelles vertical as it sounds. And then we also do the rolling takeoff, like you said. And from there, we put the nacelles, which go from 96 degrees all the way forward to 0 degrees. We'll put them at 60 degrees. We'll hold the brakes. And once we get to that 60-degree mark, the airplane's going to want to roll forward unless you're holding on the brakes. We make sure everybody's ready, then we let off the brakes, we start rolling, we slowly beat in power at that point. We get to about 40% of our full power, and we have to basically keep the runway center line at that point. And then basically when we get enough air over the wings to develop lift, the airplane will lift itself off. The nose initially wants to rise, so we have to kind of push the nose down to keep it level, and then we climb out at that point. Right as we initially develop lift, we'll put in full power, and then we'll lift right off the runway at that point. It takes about 1,000 feet to get at 60 degrees in the cell. If we choose, say we have a short runway, we'll lift off at 70 degrees or even 75 degrees of nacelle rotation, and we'll go full power within like 3 seconds, and then we'll be off the deck in less than 100 feet. It all depends on how much weight we have, how hot it is outside, and if we can actually get off.
Is there a standard speed you're going to hit?
We'll generally hit about 55 to 40 knots, or correction, between 40 to 55 knots is what we'll hit, depending on altitude or elevation, pressure altitude, and then how quickly we get the full power in.
And talk to me about run-on landings.
It's not something we practice as much as we probably should, but it's something that we do have in our toolbox to use if we need it. We generally use it for if we are heavy coming into a landing zone or coming into a runway. We could obviously ask to go to a runway for a run-on landing. But we can do the calculations ahead of time. We usually will use about anywhere from 1,000 feet to 2,000 feet to do the full run-on landing. We'll come in at about 75 nacelle, basically nacelle angle. And as we get a little closer, we'd like to be around 80 nacelle angle. We'll touch down no more than 88 knots, but we usually touch down about 50 knots as we touch down. It's basically like a flare, like you would on a regular airplane, slowly come down to the runway. And then as you get there, slightly nose back. Squeak it on, if you will, and then power comes full out, and the nacelles go all the way back to 96 degrees, which is our to help us slow down, like aerodynamic braking. And then once we get to below 20 knots, we'll apply steady brake pressure to slow ourselves down. And like I said, 1,000 feet, up to 2,000 feet if we're really heavy and we come in really, really fast, but about 1,000 feet or less.
Still staying in our geek side, tell us about the coolest place to land.
I'd say the most interesting and probably challenging place that we land is on the ship or out in the ocean. So we are primarily a soldiers from the sea. That's the whole Marine motto. So to go along with that, all of our airplanes are made to land on naval shipping. We land on what's called a LHD or an LPD. Those are two types of naval ships, smaller than a big aircraft carrier, but they're still big ships themselves. Generally about 70 feet off the water is the flight deck. And if you can picture same look of a full-size aircraft carrier, just slightly smaller. We'll come in at about 300 feet to the for our pattern altitude. We'll come in, slow down, start coming down toward our hover altitude over the ship. So you picture 70 feet above the water, and then 30 feet above that as our hover altitude as we slide over the ship.
Roger, but you're not coming into the back of the ship. You're coming in parallel on the left side, correct?
True. So we do come parallel to the ship. Once we get a beam, our landing point, we'll make a left turn, and then we'll basically set up for landing as we're coming into landing on the ground. We'll do our standard slowdown, looking for approximately 150 feet and 50 knots as we're coming to about 50 feet over the deck edge. We'll start our slowdown, and basically we'll pedal turn so that the nose goes parallel to the ship's travel, and then we'll slide from left to right over the ship. And because of the unique engine orientation and rotor orientation of the V-22, the right rotor is going to be in-ground effect and the left rotor is going to be out-of-ground effect at that time. So to compensate for that, our flight control system that we have compensates, and it doesn't take away power from any engines, but it compensates in the tip pad plane of the rotors. If you watch it at night, you'll see the rotors actually doing a dance. If you look at it on night vision goggles, they're adjusting to keep you centered over the spot that you're trying to keep centered over. And at that point, you'll be able to get yourself centered. The crew chiefs will call you level, straight, and then you listen to the crew chiefs the entire time. They're like, come left three, come left five, come right, come back. And then once you clear up the spot, clear down, you'll slowly take, I shouldn't say slowly, you'll judiciously take power out to establish about a 300-foot rate of per minute of descent. Come straight down. It's a firm landing, but it gets you right on the spot. You come right through ground effect. That lasts a little bit because we have what's called lateral darting. Below at about 15 feet, the engines will start to create some kind of differential thrust, and you'll start sliding back and forth. You don't want to do that over the ship because you might slide back out over the ocean. So that's why you push through that with about 300 feet per minute rate of descent, smack down on the deck. It's sometimes a little scary, but for the most part, it's just challenging and fun.
Well, thank you, Captain Fernandez. This is Launchpad Marzari saying frequency change approved. Good day.
All right. Those V-22s, you know, guys, at some point in time, I've got to get myself somewhere close to a V-22 landing, launching, taking off. I just have to see how these things look and sound. It just strikes me as such a, I don't know, sort of a complex kind of a way to fly. It's big engines and those big rotors rotating in that way. I think, have either of you guys seen one of these things up close?
Yeah, I have. I was in Western Colorado, Gunnison, probably about 5-6 years ago, and they were doing testing all summer long there, and they had a couple of them, and they would just sit and hover over the runway, which was fascinating to watch them at low altitude maneuver. And I was kind of surprised. I walked upstairs in the FBO and opened the door, and boom, there were about a dozen engineers all sitting there at their laptops, all kind of looking up going, and who are you? So, yeah, they were doing their high-altitude testing that summer at Gunnison, Arizona. But, yeah, they're awfully darn noisy, but really cool to see.
Wow. All right. Well, we want to thank Launchpad Marzari for recording those interviews. Really appreciate it, giving us a little insight into some of the things that he saw at the Heart of Texas Air Show. Thanks again, Launchpad. All right. Well, with that, I think that's it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast. We want to thank you all for listening. And, of course, we want to thank our guest, Matt Desch, CEO of Iridium Communications. Find them at iridium.com. You can find us at airplanegeeks.com. Show notes for this episode are at airplanegeeks.com/445. The website also has links where you can find us on social media, how to contact us, how to subscribe, and there's also a donate button if you'd like to help support the show financially. All right, well, let's tell folks where they can find us online. Rob Mark, we'll start with you.
Well, they can find me at flyingmag.com inside the pages of Flying Magazine. Down at Sun and Fun next week, if you're down there, you can always send me a little tweet there on Jetwine, which is our other alter ego, and that anything that has Jetwine in the name of it.
Ian Max Trescott, how about you?
Well, this month only, you can see me on page 20 of AOPA magazine. So go ahead and whip out Pilot magazine, and you'll see me with a column up front there. But normally, you just go ahead and look for me on Twitter as Max Trescott. Or you can also go to SJ, short for San Jose Flight.com, if you're out in the Bay Area here and want to do some flying.
And you can find me on Twitter at Max Flight. Look for me on LinkedIn, also with David Vanderhoof at theuavdigest.com. And with Mary Kirby on PaxXPodcast.com. Our intro music is by Brother Love. Find him at BrotherLoveRocks.com. Outro by Bruno Massone. You can find him at BrunoMassone.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Bye, everybody.
Good night, everybody. Thanks for listening.
And keep the blue side up.